listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have with me once again Dan Oliver. Thanks for joining me again today, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you with me. And I want you, before we get into this topic of the day, timing the crash, talk a little bit about the Committee for Monetary Research and Education, or CMRE for short, its purpose, and tell us a little bit about the upcoming meeting that's occurring on October 3rd.
Sure, yeah. The CMRE was founded in 1970 by Henry Hazlitt and fellow traveler Jacques Gareff was involved, a bunch of the real Triffin, of all stripes, who basically in opposition to the Bretton Woods monetary agreement. They saw as early as 1970, before Nixon took us off the gold standard, that the monetary mechanism was going to collapse, and they warned about it. Of course, at first they were very much outliers, and then all the things they predicted happened over the 70s as the dollar collapsed and gold soared. And so in the 70s, it was quite influential, full of Fed governors and heads of banks, people who really understood the gold standard and wanted to go back to it. Of course, that's not completely anachronistic. We don't often get Fed governors coming to argue in favor of the gold standard these days. But the organization persists, and the event we're having in New York City on October 3rd, I think, is very interesting. It's going to be on cryptocurrencies, and we have Joe Lubin, who's one of the co-founders of Ethereum, which is the second largest cryptocurrency coming. We have George Gilder coming. We have Larry White coming. And what the focus of the meeting is going to be about is not so much the question that I think most hard money folks ask themselves, which is better, gold or Bitcoin? Is Bitcoin the new gold? Because what that presumes is, where do you put your savings? Do you want to keep your life savings in gold and Bitcoin? And I certainly have my own views on that. But I think the more interesting question is transactional. The original function of banks, if we go all the way back to medieval Europe, was to settle commercial transactions. A chain of production, different merchants would pay each other not in silver, because silver was very scarce and was also dangerous to transport. There were brigands and tax collectors, all sorts of things. That they would pay each other in IOUs and commercial bills, and these bills would circulate in the economy, and the banks would settle them. That is the proper function of banks, not to finance assets, but to settle commercial credit. And what really interests me about these cryptocurrencies is, and especially Ethereum, is the idea of the smart contract, which essentially take the bank out of the equation. So if one company orders widgets from another company, when the widgets arrive, the settlement happens automatically. And what this raises the potential of doing is essentially disaggregating the banks from commerce. And I think that is a much bigger story, much bigger possibility than most conversations about this topic involve with. Now, again, the commercial bills in the Middle Ages matured into gold, whereas the current ones mature into cryptocurrency. So I think that's an issue that needs to be addressed. And it's not to have any conclusions at the meeting. It's to get people who really know this stuff to come and talk about it and get different viewpoints on these matters. So I think it'll be a fascinating evening, and again, attacking what I think is a much more interesting opportunity than usually gets aired in these conversations.
All right, Dan, for people who are listening that might be able, living in the New York City area or so, to attend, how do they go about doing so?
Yeah, well, seating is limited, but we still have seats available, and they just go to the website, cmre.org, and there's a link right there to buy tickets, and we still have some seats available.
All right, great. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm certainly looking for a resumption of the meetings from the CMRE meetings. We missed them. There's been a little bit of a lull here. Now that you've taken over, I'm really happy to see it back on track. Well, I do want to, you know, get into the topic of today. I've actually titled today's show "Timing the Crash" after your excellent article that you wrote here on August 15th, I believe it was. Timing the Crash. you know, you what makes you think that there will be a crash, Dan? You know, I mean, certainly if you were to, most people probably, they continue throwing their money into the stock market. They seem to be oblivious, and there seems to be growing confidence, as there always is, when you have year after year of bull markets. Tell us what leads you to believe that this thing can't go on forever.
Well, I guess it's a matter of perspective. You know, if the way the Fed views the world, that the economy by its nature does not tend towards equilibrium, it tends to be chaotic, and so you need a wise and powerful central bank to keep things on you know, on an even keel. And you know, Janet Yellen gave an absurd speech a couple years ago where she said, "Look, we've gotten better at it. We've learned. You know, look, we managed to conquer the '87 crash, and then we you know, contained the S&L crisis, and then the internet bubble. Like, we had all these tools we use, and guess even the housing bubble, the biggest one of all. You know, we were able to QEs and all these programs. We solved it. So we're getting better and better at solving these problems. And it's so absurd because, of course, it's the Fed that's causing these problems, and they're causing them by keeping the economy in an artificial state. The economy does tend towards equilibrium in a free market. The problem is that we haven't had a free market in money, in interest rates, for at least 100 years, and in some sense 200 years. And so because the Fed manipulates the currency system, it naturally blows these bubbles. And it's not just the Fed, it's the banking system. And that's one of the points of the piece I wrote. You know, there were big bubbles and crashes in the 19th century before the central bank. So obviously the Fed isn't causing it, but what causes it is the fraction of the banking system, which has been around for a couple hundred years. And the good thing about the 19th century is that, yes, there were more panics, but they were smaller. And so the economy didn't get too far off track for too long because everything would liquefy, and it was very unpleasant living through it, to be sure. But within, you know, there was no stabilization so that values returned to where they should be. It had been picked up and moved on, which is why the century is so productive. And in the 20th century and now in the 21st, we have this central bank managing the situation. And so they try to keep the economy at an incorrect price level, interest rates at an incorrect level for as long as they can. And so it does make the crashes less frequent, but it also makes them much, much worse. And that's what's happening. So it's the nature of the bank system to blow these bubbles, and it's the nature of the Fed to resist the popping, and that's what they're doing. So if you look back at that history of the last couple hundred years, you see a very clear pattern, which is that what these fractional banks do is they create credit. They don't allocate credit. That's, of course, the dirty secret of banking. They don't take your savings and give it to some needy person who's going to use them. They take your savings and multiply them. And take your overnight money, because it's deposits overnight, and they lend it to some other guy at 30 years, at 10 times the amount. So it creates too much credit, artificial credit, pushes down interest rates. This is the natural thing that happens. So what you generally see is very gradually falling interest rates over periods of time as this process happens, and then you get more and more asset inflation as the money goes into assets. And then in the 19th century, what happened is, all of a sudden, because interest rates were so low, savers would take their money out of the bank. It's just not worth it for me to have my money in the bank. I can self-invest or do something else. And so rates would climb, and the higher rates would devalue these malinvestments, and you'd have a big banking crisis. In modern times, what happens is that the Fed sees the asset inflation. Their self-described job is to take away the punch bowl, right? So they start raising rates willingly, not because they want to end the boom. They like the boom because in the boom, tax revenue goes higher, and the government likes that. So they don't want to end, but they want to, you know, control it. So they raise rates, and then inevitably you see, within a couple of years or maybe within a few years, a big crash. And the point of my article is you go back and look at the major episodes of the last 100 years, and you see the exact same pattern, which is that once rates start to rise, it tells you that the credit cycle has peaked and it's ending, and the crash will come soon. Now, to be very clear, often in that first rising of the rates, prices go crazy. So the Fed in 1928 got spooked, and they started raising rates in Q1 of 1928. And they raised rates through September of 1929. And during that year and a half, the reason they kept raising rates is because the stock market kept going crazy. It kept going higher and faster and faster. So they raised rates more and more to try to contain it. And they were basing the market higher, which they were. And all of a sudden, the rates hit an amount where basically people's cash flows dissipate. If you have too much debt and the rates go up, now all of a sudden you're paying more on your student loans and your car payments and your mortgage payments and your credit card payments. And so now your cash disappears. And so the whole thing collapses, which is what happened in 1929. And the same thing happened to Bernanke, right? He started raising rates, I think, in 2004 for 3 years. And that was the really hot time of the market of the housing bubble, those 3 years of rising rates. But then one day the rates hit a level that the bubble just couldn't sustain, and we popped very suddenly. So I think it's no surprise that Fed's been raising rates now for about 20 months. And during that time, the market's gone higher and higher at a faster and faster pace. And this is entirely consistent with what's happened before. But there's a level at which the rates will hit, that the whole system will lock up. And if you look back at the last 30 years in this sort of mega cycle we've been in, the rate at which the height to which rates have to go to tank the system is lower and lower because the debt burden gets higher and higher. So it's not that rates have to go back to where they were in 2007 to tank the market. They just have to go back to higher than whatever number it is, and it's not easy to know what the number is because the economy is a very complex, chaotic system. But there's a number at which the cash flow gets interrupted to the extent that the whole credit cycle goes into reverse. And I think, you know, it's been 20 months. When you look back again, you know, these things tend to take, I don't know, two to 4 years. And so we're sort of on the cusp of when it could crash. Maybe it could last in a year or two. But there's another thing that happened, which I think is very interesting, and that is gold has been rising through the end of the summer. And then all of a sudden, when Houston got washed away, gold had a nice pop, right?
Yes.
And I was very interested in that because my next letter, I think, is going to be about this. It was the destruction of San Francisco in 1906 that prompted the panic of 1907. What happened was when 80% of the city was leveled, within a few months, 15% of England's gold supply had sailed across the Atlantic to settle insurance claims. And so the Bank of England had to raise rates to prevent more gold from leaving England. And on top of that, people who lost their houses obviously had to take their savings out of the bank system to rebuild. So there was huge pressure on the banks. And then within a year, the collapse of 1907 happened, which ironically prompted the creation of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
And so I think it's historically interesting that here we are at the peak of a credit cycle, the largest the world's ever seen, and we had the fourth largest city by GDP in the U.S. washed away in a storm. And they almost lost Florida, too. That would have been interesting because that's actually what happened to the Florida boom in, I think it was 1925, the hurricane came and flattened half the state. The Fed actually lowered rates after that to keep that boom going, which also helped contribute to the phenomenal rise at the late of the 1920s. But so here we are with, again, these people in Houston who have insurance claims. They have just the people who aren't insured are going to have to liquidate their financial assets to try to rebuild. In fact, I saw apparently Congress is considering a bill to allow people to sell securities out of their 401ks tax-free to pay for rebuilding, which is great, but it means, you know, if that passes, you'll have lots of sellers of assets to rebuild. So, again, I mean, is Houston big enough? It's not. I don't think Houston is big as San Francisco was in 1906. On the other hand, we have massive more leverage than we had then. So it's hard to get precise, too precise on these macro trends that last decades. But the point is that we're in a rising rate cycle now, usually that at first creates strongly rising asset prices, and then you hit a point at which the whole thing collapses.
Right. Dan, with all these demands now from Florida and from Houston, from, you know, southeastern Texas, the carnage, the rebuilding, and so on and so forth, you would think that would probably cause the Fed to be even easier to maybe not raise rates as rapidly as they intended to, and I thought maybe that's one of the reasons that the gold market showed some strength after Houston, and then the Fed came out, I think yesterday or somebody at the Fed came out and said no, we're gonna raise just as we had planned to before. To what extent do you think the Fed is in charge of, the Fed is in control of this, or are they reacting to market forces?
Well, again, I think it's a little bit of both. I think I don't agree with the more conspiracy-minded as the Fed that causes these bubbles. Again, we know that because they happened in the 19th century and the Fed wasn't around. The Fed's function is to contain the bus when it happens. That was the original function, and it still serves that function. Again, that's a very bad thing to do, but that is, in fact, what it does. So I think the stresses in the economy are such that the Fed is generally led by the market, but then it can and does push back strenuously, as it did in 2008 and 2009 when it suspended market accounting, when it guaranteed $7 trillion of assets the first few months, when it had the QE program. So it can definitely influence things. But in and of itself, I don't think it's powerful enough to stop these enormous forces that cause overbuilding in you know, largest in assets, overcapacity, flying prices, and the bust. I mean, that is a cycle that's been happening for thousands of years, not hundreds. And the Fed, again, I think, has the ability to accentuate those things, but they certainly can't stop them.
Dan, there's no question in your mind that we're going to have a major decline in the equity markets. I believe I'm safe in saying that. How do you think?
On a real basis, Jay, let's be careful. I mean, okay. Weimar Germany was a credit collapse. It just was a hyperinflationary one. So, I mean,
in nominal terms gold, it went, the market went higher.
Zimbabwe. So yes, the equity markets will go down. You know, historically, you know, a 90% decline in terms of gold is what happens. I mean, that happened certainly in the 30s nominally. It also happened in the 70s. In gold terms, people didn't notice it because the nominal price didn't go down that much. In fact, they went up most of the decade. But the point is, yes, I mean, equity prices, real estate prices, all those heavily levered assets will go down in the final crash by magnitudes of 90-95%.
Well, your article outlines a whole list of sectors in our economy that are almost in a depression state. The retail sector, the housing sector is in trouble, lots and lots of things. Yet the stock market... Stock market continues to go up. But Dan, with just 2 minutes left here, I've got to ask you, though, how do you think gold will fare when this market declines, when the equity market declines?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. In 2008, what happened was you get a short squeeze in currency, and so people dump all their assets, including gold, because if you don't have cash, you don't pay your debts, you lose your collateral. So gold got hit initially, and the second Lehman Brothers started teetering, then gold got a huge hit, right? And then the QE happened, off it went. My own view is I don't know that gold goes up directly when the crash happens. It seems to be behaving pretty much in lockstep in opposition to the stock market, which can be some confidence it does. I think it could go down. I don't really know. But what I do strongly suspect is everyone's seen the movie recently. So even if it goes down initially, and again, I don't know that it does, but it certainly might, everyone knows what comes next, which is huge intervention by central banks attacking the currency and gold going higher. So that process will happen at a much more rapid rate than it did last time. So even if gold gets hit, I think it'll go up much faster and much further than it did last time because the forces involved are that much bigger.
Yeah, well, it certainly is a very, very interesting times. You know, the Chinese and the Russians, the BRICS, the One Belt, One Road competition, do you see anything there that might interfere with the dollar? And with just about a minute left here yet, if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese build bridges to boost GDP. Now, are the bridges productive or not? That's a different question. And certainly that can put a bid on our commodities, and that can help the banks that lent commodities money. I mean, they can extend the cycle perhaps somewhat and you know, use overcapacity they have in China to do something. But yeah, is it productive? Do we think that central planning works, that some apparatchik decides to put a road somewhere and creates a market? I mean, lots of lefties think that. I don't think that's how the world works, so we'll see.
All right, we'll see. We'll have to leave it go at that, a topic for another day. Thanks so much for being with us, Dan, and we'll look to do it again sometime soon, hopefully.
Thanks for having me.
Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, the title of my show will be Unlike Trump, Kennedy Never Bent a Knee. And you will hear a portion of speeches made by President Eisenhower warning of the military-industrial complex, which has, in fact, now seemingly taken over our country. At least some people feel that way. And also a speech by President Kennedy to journalists warning about secret societies and the need for journalists to dig deep into seeking the truth. Former trial lawyer Jacob Hornberger will comment on both of those speeches by our former presidents. And Daniel McAdams and Jeff Deist will comment on how our country has ignored both of those speeches to our own detriment. It should be a very interesting show next week, so I hope you'll join me. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.